educational side of things, 1945, against the Teddy Bourgeoisie, my father. And today we'll wind up that and go on to another struggle that broke out in our party after the war, and also the conditions of our party during the war, as well as after the war. Now, to sum up the fight of 1940, we had our convention in April. And at the convention, we found out that we had a majority. That is, we defenders of the party program. But in an overall picture of the numbers, we found out that the revisionists had taken the youth almost entirely, except for the worker youth who remained loyal to the party and its program. But the overwhelming majority went with Shockman. And the overwhelming majority were mainly students. Now, the convention was more or less a meeting of the cannon faction, because the Shockman gang had already obtained the headquarters. They were utilizing the youth organization to put out a newspaper, and in general were prepared to go into business on their own. We may say that the party split right down the middle. That's just about what it was. About 50-50. And almost to a man, on one side there was the petty bourgeois elements, with a worker here and there. It was almost known nationally, the name of every worker that went with the minority, with the Shockman gang, because they were so rare. Out of a party faction of possibly 40 sailors, only one sailor went with Shockman and his gang, and he was a pitiful creature. You see in the book some of the writings refer to some of the letters signed with the name of O'Brien. Well, he was the one that went with Shockman, and he was a nonentity, so he didn't mean anything one way or the other. Put down in cold facts and in cold arithmetic, there's no doubt about it that Shockman took the majority of the Trotskyists in this country, adding up the youth and the party members. It went with Shockman. Of course, it was dual membership and so forth, but in an overall number, Shockman took the majority. And it left the party with no youth organization. We had no youth organization from the split of 1940 up until the organization of the Young Socialist Alliance 4 or 5 years ago. It gives you an idea of the strength that Shockman had among the youth, and it also gives you a picture of the caliber of the youth that we had in 1940. And we'll talk about the caliber of the youth of 1940 and the caliber of the youth of 1965 next week. Now, this ripping part of the organization on a 50-50 basis would ordinarily result in a terrible debacle for both sides because of such a division. But what did we say in the first talk? What did we say about the frontispiece that Lenin used in What Is to Be Done? A party through internal struggle purges itself and therefore strengthens itself. And you never saw a more determined and more enthusiastic organization than the Socialist Workers' Party was after the April Convention of 1940. We had just suffered this terrible split in our ranks, and I say ordinarily it would mean death to an organization, but it was just the opposite, and it was a great confirmation of what Lenin said. By purging the party of this pessimistic, crybaby, petty bourgeois element, the ranks of the party closed and marched forward. Now, during the struggle, we had several times made statements of slander against the Shockman gang. Pardon. And the slander consisted of the fact that a large number of them were in opposition to the party program and using it as a cover to desert and run away from the class struggle. Well, hardly had they gone into business when Professor Burnham issued his famous statement that he's all through. Imagine what a scoundrel this pretentious individual was. The peddler of honesty and truth and so forth and so on. He leads a whole section of the party in revolt against the party program and leads them into a split situation. And after they split, he just very calmly sends them a letter and says, I'm all through. I think it's all a lot of baloney, this working class political party stuff. Probably 2 weeks' time, he broke with the Shockman gang and went back to bourgeois life. Inside of 1 year, Shockman's gang, that must have numbered at least 600, in 1 year was down to 200 members. 1 year. Needless to say, the Socialist Workers' Party, in 1 year's time, increased its membership. I don't know just how much, but we can. I'll give an estimate later on over the war period. Now, as Cannon said somewhere or other in his writing on the struggle for the proletarian party, quoting Engels, that Engels used to like to say, the proof is in the pudding. And if anything was was proof and a confirmation of the majority being correct and standing by and defending this program, it was the fact that the Shockman gang was decimated inside of 1 year. We didn't know less that the exact figures that the Shockman gang had, the number of members that had deserted, until the Johnson group joined us after the war. And they told us that by the end of the first year, the Shockman gang was horribly demoralized over the fact that they lost all these members. And they had branches in certain sections of the country, very few branches, but they were only of a nuisance. That's all they were. We didn't bother with them, we didn't fight them. There was nothing to fight. The argument was all settled. And as I say, the proof was in the pudding, in the meeting where it was very apart. And the only thing was that they stirred up the muddy water. And by that I mean that if they were in the same union with our comrades, they pretended themselves, they passed themselves off as Trotskyists, and they caused a lot of confusion as to why you're a Trotskyist and you're not in the same party with this other guy that says he's a Trotskyist too. That was the only trouble that we had with them. Yeah, they couldn't recruit because to the average worker there was very little difference between the two organizations. The Soviet Union didn't mean anything to the average worker. And the question always would be put to the Shockman gang, I imagine, by a serious worker. Why don't you unite with these people? Why did you split from them? And they had to hide all these... they had to hide the terrible debacle of 1940, they had to hide the truth of it from any recruits that they were trying to get into their party. When Walport and Maine, the leaders of Shockman's gang, the youth gang, that rebelled against Shockman going into the Socialist Party, when they first contacted us and obtained the literature of the split of 1940, they were amazed because they had been told just the opposite. And they didn't bother to read the documents of the fight. The only place they could get the documents of the fight was to come over to the Socialist Workers' Party and get a copy of Trotsky's Defense of Marxism and Cannon's A Struggle for a Proletarian Party. And when they read this, they said, geez, we were told just the opposite. And that had a great influence on them. Now, we lead Shockman through his troubles. As I said, Burnham quit. And he wasn't the only leader that quit. The heroes of the immigrant heroes that were strutting around as exile leaders of the various sections in Europe also went with Shockman. And almost to a man, inside of a year, they had quit politics too. But the Socialist Workers' Party bounced full from this split. Industry was opening up due to the war. The shipbuilding industry, auto, steel, maritime, and so forth. And our comrades poured into these industries. Inside of a year, 2 years, we had big fractions in all of these industries. At one time, when the sweep was put on during McCarthyism, we had about 125 comrades in maritime. We had about 125 comrades in auto during the great General Motors strike of 1946, which we'll talk about. We had 60, 70 comrades in the steel industry. We had a rubber fraction in Akron, Ohio. We had a fraction in the electrical industry, and so on, up and down the line. The party, all through the war and up to the convention of 1946, was 95% working class. So that we came out of this, as I said before, terrifically strengthened and extremely cocky, as Cannon would say, because we saw a world war, and our documents foretold and Trotsky foretold the collapse of European capitalism and the ushering in of the socialist United States of Europe. We were confident to the last comrade in the party that the socialist revolution was on the agenda in Europe. Now, to give you an idea of the resoluteness of the ranks of the party after the split of 1940, we have to get a complete picture of just what was the condition of the United States at that time and the condition inside the party. Trotsky was assassinated on August 21st, 1940. He is the great international leader of Marxism, a man that had a direct interest in the Socialist Workers' Party, a man who considered the American Party his party, that is the party that he belonged to in the international. The man who taught the world Trotskyist movement, the Fourth International, everything that it knew about fascism, everything it knew about the Soviet Union and the degeneration of the Soviet Union. The man that taught us everything we knew about the entire world situation is assassinated by the Stalinists. It was a terrible blow. It was a terrible blow to the party because the party wouldn't move 2 feet forward without consultation with Trotsky. Side by side with this, the United States government passed a law called the Voorhees Act. The Voorhees Act made it illegal for any political party in this country to have any kind of international connections, unless you submitted your membership list to the War Department or the State Department, and so forth and so on. And that bill, that act went into effect at the end of 1940. At the end of 1940, we had a special convention at which the party had only one point on the agenda, and that was to disaffiliate from the Fourth International because it was against the law, and the Trotskyists are law-abiding Americans. So we disaffiliated, and therefore complied with the law. The Levstonite organization that I've spoken to you before about, this great pretentious organization, these apologists of Stalinism, these careers and opportunists, used the Voorhees Act as a means of signing their death warrant. They issued their paper with a statement that they were this had a convention and that they had voted unanimously to dissolve. Imagine that. What a horrible debacle. They said in the course of this long declaration that they had come to the conclusion that the best way that they could serve Marxism and the revolutionary movement was by dissolving. And the same applied to every other organization in the country. That was another blow against the party. Then we had the Smith Act passed. You know, every time the capitalists go to war, they pass more laws to try to regulate and hamstring the working class. If we go back to the sedition laws passed in the second administration, the administration of Adams, the second president of the United States, to try to hamstring the American people against supporting the French Revolution. Then during the Civil War, they passed another mountain of laws. And after the Civil War, they passed another mountain of laws during the Reconstruction period. And incidentally, they don't have to pass laws about new laws to give the Afro-American the right to vote and all that nonsense. The laws are on the books. The laws are on the books. They were passed during the Civil War and after the Civil War. And anytime they want to enforce those laws, all they have to do is send the army down. And they can take these degenerate politicians, that fellow from Louisville, the great white fellow, when he spoke over half a column, stumblebums. The stumblebum politicians of the South, and just hang them, period, with a military tribunal. That's all. No courts. This nonsense that they have to pass laws to give the Negro the right to vote in the South is just a lot of bull. Well, it's the same thing with the laws of the working class. The capitalists passed these, and then the First World War came, they passed another bundle of laws to the so-called syndicalist laws that could convict you for saying anything. Now, the Smith Act was quite different. The Smith Act is a law that makes it a crime to think about conspiracy, not to enter a conspiracy, but to think about it. You're saying that's impossible. That's what the law is. The Smith Law, and you notice the United States Supreme Court always refuses to review it because these politicians that they appointed to the Supreme Court, like this thug Tom Clark that Truman appointed, because he was involved in the shakedown of the insurance companies in Missouri. So in order to cover him up, Truman put him on the Supreme Court. Well, these thugs like Clark and liberals and so forth refused to review the Smith Act because it's obviously against the Constitution of the country. Well, this law was passed in order to hamstring the Reds in the coming struggle that was going to break out, the World War number two. Now, all of these laws were passed. And on top of that, the leadership of the Socialist Workers' Party was indicted and brought to trial, 28 members. The comrades of Minneapolis were driven out of the Teamsters Union with the cooperation of the federal government and so forth. Now here's a whole series of blows against this tiny little organization of approximately about 500 members. The international leader is assassinated by the Stalinists. The Smith Act is passed, the Boris Act is passed. The leadership of the organization is rounded up and put in jail. And yet, instead of collapsing and the membership running in the corner and bemoaning the terrible tragedies that were hounding it, the membership bounced back. There was absolutely no sense of a feeling of defeatism or self-pity or anything. It was all taken in its stride as, well, what the hell, the capitalists are at war and they have to fight the war on the home front too, and we declared war on capitalism when we joined the Socialist Workers' Party, didn't we? When we joined the Socialist Workers' Party, we're declaring war on the capitalists. And we have to be ready to take the consequences. If we're not, we shouldn't be in the party. They always say, hell, you might as well die if you're fighting for yourself, it's fighting for J.P. Morgan, and that's what you're going to do if you're in the army. So what the hell, you might as well die fighting for yourself. I think it's a lot more sensible. Well, the party bounced back, as I said, and we really bounced back. Everything was taken in a stride. When the comrades were arrested under the Smith Act, we raised holy hell right through this whole country. We rounded up hundreds and hundreds of liberals to protest this act, to protest the arrest of our comrades. We appealed to the trade unions throughout the whole country, locals and internationals. Like the International, the Automobile Workers, at their international convention. We had resolutions passed there, protesting the arrest of our comrades. At the International Garment Workers Union, and so forth up and down the line. At the National Convention of the CIO, not just one CIO union, but the whole CIO convention, we presented a resolution calling for the support of the CIO. And Philip Murray, who was the president then of the CIO, made his famous statement to some people about the resolution. He said, the Trotskyites are screwballs, but they're honest. You know what I mean? He was drawing a line between Stalinists and us. In other words, we had prestige. We were respected for, not for our ideas, but we were respected as an organization that told the truth and went double deals. And this paid off. This paid off. We raised tens and tens of thousands of dollars from unions, not from individuals, but from the unions, to help in the defense of our comrades and then to support their wives and children while they were in prison. We'll come to what the Stalinists got. Every organization, every political organization in this country Every liberal organization, not to mention just plain politicians and plain individuals, supported the Socialist Workers' Party in its fight against the Smith Act. But everyone but one organization, that was the Stalinists. We would send comrades down to different unions appealing for money and for an endorsement of the fight against the Smith Act. And if there was a Stalinist in that local union meeting, he or she would get up and explain how the Trotsky Act had come for revolutionaries, and they're hampering the war machine against our country, and so forth and so on, and it would be a traitorous thing for our union to give money to these counter-revolutionary fascist agents. Well, the workers remember that several years later. Out of the Minneapolis trial came Cannon's book, Socialism on Trial, a question-answer book on socialism that has been translated into numerous languages throughout the world Trotskyist movement. During the war, while our comrades were in prison, the party leaped forward and started to recruit like the devil. From the split of 1940 to the end of the war, we doubled our membership. We doubled our membership during the war. We set up new branches in various cities throughout the country. And we gradually started to become a power, a small power, in the automobile union and in the maritime union. As I say, we paid no attention to the Shachtman gang who paraded around under the name of the Workers' Party. In 1946, we had our national convention. We had the largest gathering, or the second largest, yeah, we had the largest gathering in the history of the Trotskyist movement in this country. Because we don't count 1938, but the founding convention where we had somewhere around 1,800 members. But a large segment of them came from the Socialist Party, as I explained before, through a misunderstanding. They didn't really know what a real Marxist Leninist organization was, and they ran away like a dozen after the convention. But the gang that came to the convention in 1946 was a different element. They were workers, overwhelmingly workers that were recruited during the war and brought into the Socialist Workers' Party. And they were workers that were recruited off the picket lines that I'll talk about in a few minutes. They were workers that had a terrific experience in the mass movement, that understood the mass movement. There were many of them secondary leaders in their local unions throughout the country. And I remember the closing remarks of Comrade Dawes at the 1946 convention, which was forward to a party of 10,000 by the next convention. That gives an idea of the fighting spirit of the membership in 1946. Well, we know what happened, that the great wave of reaction came in and so forth, and we'll talk about that in a second, please. Now, let's look at this Communist Party. The Communist Party in 1939 turned down 100,000. We'd give them the benefit of the doubt and say they had 75,000. But they weren't members like we had, of course. They didn't know beef and pork. The Social Democrats knew nothing about Marxism, and the Communists knew less. it's an unbelievable thing that an organization founded on the principles of the Russian Revolution could degenerate to such a state that its membership didn't know beans from pork about not only Marxism, but knew nothing about the history of the Russian Revolution, the Russian Bolshevik Party, or anything of that nature. Now they went into the war with something like 75,000 or 100,000 members. They were a powerful organization, controlled the whole radical movement, top to bottom. Nobody could get a word in edgewise, Trotskyist, socialist, or anybody else, unless you kowtow to the Stalinist Party. I told you, Thomas, that they had a fraction of 200 over at Harvard College here, 200 YCLs, Young Communist League. Well, let's see what happened to them. The first part of 1939, they're yakking at the top of their mouth about collective security. We must get together all the well-meaning, good people of goodwill, into one organization and fight for collective security against the barbarism of fascism, of Hitlerism. And we do this through a collective security pact. All the good capitalists, like the United States capitalists, they're fine people, and the good capitalists of France and the good capitalist government of Britain should unite into a military bloc against Hitler, naturally with the Soviet Union, unite with the Soviet Union. And Roosevelt was a noble man. He was trying to, leading the great struggle in this country against the spread of fascism. And he was, poor Roosevelt used to go to bed at night crying for the welfare of the working class. This is the crack from the Daily Liar, Daily Jerker, and a dozen other names that radical workers had for the swill peddled out by the Stalinist party in their paper. And in 1939, the first part of 1939, by this time they were experienced strike breakers. John L. Lewis, the founder of the CIO, was a man that sat next to God. He was a great man, and the Stalinists, their idea of being unprincipled people, of course they had no other way of being a service to John L. Lewis, but by sniveling in front of him, and being his errand boy, being his hatchet man, in all kinds of trade union problems and so forth. Then when John L. Lewis bet the CIO, put the CIO on the auction block and bet that that Roosevelt would be defeated in 1940, or else he'd resign as president of the CIO, John L. Lewis appointed his flunky Murray to replace him as president of the CIO. And the Stalinists dropped John L. Lewis like a hot potato, and from then on became the servile tools of Philip Murray. Now, here's the Stalinists the first part of the year. They're yelling for collective security, down with fascism. They're Roosevelt's political gangsters, beating up opposition and so on. And there were strike breakers in the trade union movement, because Murray, John L. didn't want strikes. They didn't want strikes. They wanted to get the thing organized and then live off of it. Well, something happened in 1939, Stalin-Hitler Pact. Now, for the second half of 1936, Roosevelt is a bloody monster. That's what Roosevelt is. And from now, all during the Stalin-Hitler Pact, Roosevelt is a big warmonger. Hitler really wants peace. He wants peace. But this monster in the White House, Roosevelt, won't let Churchill sit down and talk peace with Hitler. Roosevelt is egging on Churchill. And between the pair of them, they're no good. Well, you can imagine what happened to the ranks in the Communist Party when they have to support Hitler underneath the board and blame everything on the other side of the fence now. Well, the intellectuals just deserve it almost to a man. Workers walked away from the party. The petty bourgeois elements just deserted it like a rat's deserting the ground, the sinking ship. Well, we come 1941. Roosevelt is a monster, so forth and so on. Churchill is another monster. And Hitler is still pleading for peace, but these guys won't sit down at the table and talk peace with him. Well, all of a sudden, Hitler kicks Comrade Stalin in the teeth and invades the Soviet Union. Hitler is no good. He's provoking the war. He's trying to spread the war. He doesn't want peace. It's Roosevelt and Churchill that want peace, and they want to destroy this monster that's causing all the trouble in the world. Well, you can imagine another flock leaving the Communist Party. These poor devils, you know, they're like robots. What do I say today? Do I cheer for Roosevelt or cheer for Hitler? Oh, wait a second. Let me see what the Daily Worker says. Let me see what the paper says. And the whole thing was, they were ridiculed and laughed out of the radical, out of the trade union movement, in the trade union movement, and in various organizations. All their fronts, like the League Against War and Fascism, blah, 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 Friends of the Soviet Union, all these collapsed overnight. Well, when the war broke out, the Stalinists were right back in their stride. When the Stalin-Hitler Pact was broken and Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, they were right back in their stride. They were now the happy-go-lucky scabs and strike-breakers, experienced from the 1930s under the leadership of Lewis and now under the leadership of Bill Murray. When they had the When they had the Stalin-Hitler Pact, they pumped up propaganda. They started all kinds of peace organizations. On the West, they had this National Mobilization for Peace. I have it at the house. One of their letterheads. And I have some other propaganda they put out. The Maritime Union on the West Coast, controlled by the Stalinists, put out a pamphlet. The Yanks aren't coming. And lo and behold, when Stalin hit the fell apart, they had to recall these pamphlets and pull them back and destroy them. They were the noblest fighters in the United States for the working class during the Stalin-Hitler Pact. The cost of living was going up, and the workers should go on strike.